This is Central Time. Now, health coverage was one of many issues in this week's lame duck session at the state capitol. State senators didn't follow up on outgoing Governor Walker's campaign promise to safeguard a provision in the Affordable Care Act that prevented insurance companies from denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. And the Republican-controlled legislature's move to limit the power of incoming Democratic Governor Tony Evers could impact how Medicaid is provided in the state and the state's status in a national lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. Our next guest is here to talk about the politics of healthcare and what comes next. Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's co-author of the book Obamacare Wars: Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Always good to be with you.
Well, let's talk about this pre-existing condition coverage, Phil. This is a big issue in the race for governor, the U.S. Senate for that matter, for the state legislature. Looking at the proposal in the state legislature, what would it have done? Would it have matched up the protections under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, you know, the proposal that failed was ultimately something that related very closely to what was debated in the gubernatorial campaign, really in a way that's kind of rare to see in a campaign. 2018 was really about pre-existing conditions. You had multiple ads from both Evers and Walker featuring cancer survivors, people with other disease conditions, and the idea that government should protect people with pre-existing conditions was just something that ultimately both candidates had to sort of get on board with. And so this bill that was in the state legislature and ultimately failed in the Senate would have sort of codified the idea that the state was going to protect people with pre-existing conditions. Now, one of the challenges with that is that if the state lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act, challenging its constitutionality, which is filed with a number of other states, if that was successful, even with having a pre-existing condition protection in place at the state level, the cost of covering people with pre-existing conditions would skyrocket, because if the ACA were struck down as unconstitutional, all of the subsidies that the federal government provides to people with those pre-existing conditions to take care of their premiums, they would go away. And so effectively the state would be on the hook for a high sort of cost for covering those people. And so, you know, this is, I think, a huge blow to the idea that the state legislature cares about the idea of covering people with pre-existing conditions. But again, I think codifying the lawsuit sort of illustrates that as well.
Now, this is kind of the central difficulty, right, of the Affordable Care Act. If you want to make sure everybody can get insurance coverage, even people with pre-existing conditions, that is going to cost insurers more, because those people with pre-existing conditions need more health coverage. So you got to do something. That was part of why we had the individual mandate, and that's part of why we had the subsidies. Without those things, it's really hard to pull off this pre-existing condition coverage, right?
That's right. And I mean, I think this is one of the other sort of ironies of what's going on in politics around the ACA right now, which is that one of the things the state legislature also did in this brief session was enacted this legislation that created a high-risk pool. So the idea here was that if something happens to the ACA, you know, this high-risk pool will be there and will help people cover some of these costs. But the irony there is that the high-risk pool, a significant portion of the funding for that high-risk pool comes from the ACA itself. So the state legislature just passed something that, if the lawsuit that Wisconsin is pursuing against the federal government is successful, the funding for that won't be there either. And so you have this kind of politics where Republicans are advancing the idea that we want to protect people with pre-existing conditions, we want to stabilize the individual marketplace, but they're also at the same time taking a set of actions that is pointing a gun at their own head and doing things that, if they're successful, are going to make it a lot harder to live up to some of those commitments.
We've got this lawsuit in the courts now. As you say, Wisconsin is one of many states making this constitutional challenge to the Affordable Care Act. If this went through and a court decided, yeah, Wisconsin and other states, you're right. The Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. It's gone. Without this bill passed in the legislature now, what would happen in Wisconsin? What would health care coverage look like in the state?
Well, I mean, you have to consider that there are two questions here. One is the Affordable Care Act, if it's ruled unconstitutional, does the Supreme Court strike down or does the court strike down just the section of the bill that deals with things like subsidies and the sort of provision of funding for people with pre-existing conditions in the individual market? If that's the case, I mean, that will be a significant effect on people who are purchasing coverage on the individual marketplace. But I think one question is, do they just strike down that part of the bill, or do they strike down the entire piece of legislation, in which case you'll also have people that gained coverage under the Medicaid expansion losing coverage. Now, Wisconsin didn't take the Medicaid expansion. And this is also kind of where I think what is driving politics around this is not just the court decision, but also what the state legislature is doing to the powers of the governor. And so one of the elements of the extraordinary session package was a provision that prevented Evers from trying to expand Medicaid without going through the legislature first. And so, you know, in a sense, sort of regardless of what happens with the court case, even if the court upholds the constitutionality of the ACA, a lot of the politics, at least in Wisconsin, are going to be driven by a conflict between the legislative and executive branches.
Talking to Phil Rocco right now, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, the Affordable Care Act. He's with us to talk about this lame duck session in the Wisconsin legislature and what it might mean for health care coverage in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the pre-existing condition bills that didn't pass in the state Senate? The Affordable Care Act lawsuit that Wisconsin is still part of, might have to stay part of despite the wishes of the governor? And how about taking that federal Medicaid money? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Right now, we continue our conversation about what healthcare could look like in the future in Wisconsin following the legislature's lame duck session. Lawmakers didn't pass a bill that would protect pre-existing conditions, and they passed bills that could block Governor-elect Tony Evers' ability to pull Wisconsin out of a lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act, also some laws on limiting the ability to accept federal Medicaid money. Our guest is Phil Rocco, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and co-author of the book Obamacare Wars. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about what happened in the state legislature as it relates to health coverage and the Affordable Care Act, and your thoughts on what happened on those issues. 800-642-1234 is the number. To your calls now, John is with us in Appleton. John, hi.
Hi. Just a thought about the extraordinary session. If the legislature wants to play hardball, can't Tony Evers just go back to them and say that he will veto everything they submit until they give him back his powers, at which point then he could do everything he was elected to do?
John, thanks a lot for the call. Some general hardball politics there, Phil. But on health care in particular, apart from an extreme measure like a veto everything plan, apart from that, within the law as passed by the legislature now, is there much that Evers could do on health care contrary to the wishes of the legislature?
I think that the legislature, both in what it's doing and in what it's trying to signal with what it's doing, is saying to Tony Evers, over our dead bodies on this legislation. And I think that one thing that would be really interesting to do is to look at what happened when the North Carolina legislature 2 years ago did the same sort of maneuver, checking the powers of an incoming Democratic governor. And one thing that I think that governor learned in the process of taking office is that he actually benefited from going on the offensive, and in a sense, making it difficult for the legislature to govern and to really forcing voters to sort of take a look at that legislature in a little bit of a different way. I think, you know, legally with some of these maneuvers, I think it's difficult for Evers to sort of challenge them in a legal sense. But I think there are examples of where governors have sort of tried to combat this attempt to limit their power. And, you know, some maneuvers are more successful than others, but Evers does have a sort of a set of evidence that he can draw on to think about what he's going to do.
One more piece of legislation passed that we haven't gotten into has to do with work requirements for people receiving Medicaid via Wisconsin. That's Badger Care. What happened there?
So when the last budget passed, the Wisconsin State Legislature gave a sort of mandate to the executive branch to prepare this waiver that would alter some parts of Badger Care, including requirements that required people to work in exchange for their eligibility. And what the legislature did in this piece of legislation was they said that very vague, flexible thing that the executive branch could design however it wished, depending on the evidence it collected. The legislature sort of ratcheted that down and said you have to include these particular provisions, and if you want to make any changes, you have to go through us. So what it did was it really limited the executive branch's power to make what it deemed to be the most sound sort of evidence-based policy. And I think one of the challenges here is that work requirements in Medicaid are sort of dubiously legal, and there have been legal challenges to work requirements in Medicaid in states like Kentucky. There's another case that's currently playing out in Arkansas. And so what the legislature is now stipulating the governor must do is advance a law that is actually sort of in the process of being challenged in the courts in other states, and create some barriers to access that may in fact violate the Medicaid statute itself. And this is why you kind of saw a huge coalition of interest groups from hospitals, insurers, the American Cancer Society, and a variety of other disease groups saying, you know, this is a huge change to the policy related to Medicaid in Wisconsin, and it was sort of pushed through in a matter of 4 days with no real analysis of how it's going to affect the coverage that people are able to receive or the budget of the state. And so there's a lot of interest group pressure. Interest groups that really deal with healthcare on a day-to-day basis weren't consulted. And so I think what will be interesting to see is how that big health-oriented coalition of patients, providers, and insurers, sort of what they do in the next sort of 3 to 6 months to mobilize an effort to try to get the legislature to maybe unwind what it's pushing forward here.
Phil, we'll leave it there for now, but watch your inbox for the next 3 to 6 months. I'm sure we'll be in touch with you again.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
That's Phil Rocco, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. He joined us to talk about what the future of health coverage could be in Wisconsin following this week's lame duck session in the legislature. A lot happened there, including a bunch of provisions related to health coverage in the state. Technology has brought a lot of changes to modern workplaces, and a lot of workers use digital forms of communication more and more, and in-person and phone conversations less and less. Even though things like email and texting and social media promised to make us feel more connected, they might be making us isolated and unhappy instead. Our next guest says that if companies make face-to-face interactions and empathy a part of the workday again, they'll get happier and more productive employees. Dan Chabelle is a New York Times bestselling author and a partner and research director at Future Workplace. His new book is called Back to Human: How Great Leaders Create Connection in the Age of Isolation. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
So happy to be here with you.
Well, you've done a lot of research in this book. You've talked to a lot of CEOs and experts on this, but this is also a personal story. You are feeling this in your own work life. Can you talk about what this experience feels like? More isolation, less connection.
I live in New York City, and the population is about 1.6 million. Whether you're walking down the street, whether you're in a corporate office space, whether you're in the subway, you're around so many people, but at the same time, no one. Because people are physically there, but not mentally, spiritually, emotionally. Instead of looking at a person, they're looking down at a screen. Based on the Virgin Pulse study of 2,000 managers and employees, we found that up to half of someone's workday is being consumed using technology instead of face-to-face. And a study by the Harvard Business Review found that one face-to-face conversation is more successful than 34 emails back and forth. So being human matters, and we can create more understanding if we pick up the phone, do a video conference, or have one face-to-face conversation.
Right. It seems like every year, every 6 months for the past 10 or 20 years, there was this new technology, this new way to chat with your coworkers, a new software that was going to help you collaborate and make you more productive. How is it actually affecting how we feel at the workplace?
Yeah. Technology has created the illusion that we're hyper-connected, that we have abundance, and that we have even a lot of friends, Facebook friends, right? When in reality, our overuse and misuse of that technology has created weaker ties, not stronger bonds in many cases. And while we think we might have a lot of friends on Facebook, if you have 150 friends on average on Facebook, only four you can rely on at a time of an emotional crisis. In meetings, we send an average of 5 texts, so no one's actually present. We're more concerned about what's going on outside of those 4 walls when we should be paying attention and respecting the person who's speaking.
Now, you write this book. It's pitched toward leaders and, I think, everyday workers. Let's talk to the boss right now, a CEO or a manager at a workplace. What would you say to them to start, tipping the scale in the other direction, how to create more, better connection among your employees?
It starts with the 4 employee engagement factors. So it has nothing to do with technology and everything to do with trust, belonging, happiness, and purpose. So if you instill those in the workplace culture, people will naturally feel comfortable being their best self at work, opening up, sharing personal things. They'll want to come to the corporate office. They'll want to pick up the phone more. A lot of the things I talk about in the book can naturally happen if you have the right culture where people feel respected and can freely share their ideas. People don't naturally want to be, someone different outside the office than they are at the office. They just want to be themselves. And I think in today's world, leaders need to empathize with employees and understand where they're coming from and provide an environment where they feel comfortable sharing ideas without repercussions. And when you do that, people won't always default to looking at a phone. They'll start to open up. They'll start to invite their coworker to lunch or for coffee. And I know this because early in my career, I just had lunch in my cubicle, and that's before we've had even advanced technology. And so knowing where I've come from and where I am now, I'm more conscious of the importance of human connection. I call my mom more than she calls me, and she's going to be 70. So I think this book is a reminder, it's an awakening that says, oh, my God, Maslow's hierarchy of needs exists. We need safety, security, food, shelter, love, and relationships. Otherwise, we'll never be fully productive.
Now, if I'm a manager, and I'm not, and that's okay, but if I was, I might be tempted to think it's a lot easier to say, okay, here's our new whatever collaboration software, our new chat function, install it, read the manual, and use it. That sounds easy compared to creating a whole new workplace culture and climate. That sounds hard, is it?
Yeah, I think it starts with a manager or a CEO, right? It's always top down. And if you show good behavior, if you practice what you preach, if you even do something as basic as saying, hey, everyone, this is what's really going on in our work environment, or I'm not so great at this skill. Can someone help me? Showing a little vulnerability, showing that everyone's human. And then having there's exercises in the book. You sit in a meeting with people on a Monday, for instance, and you say, hey, everyone, come with a new idea to the meeting and we'll hash it out. But I want to hear everyone's idea. So that gives people a sense of belonging. And you ensure that you're not punishing people for bad ideas or making fun of them. You're embracing them, even if that idea isn't the final solution. Together, through healthy arguments and discussion, you can come up with something that's going to be good for everyone and benefit the company.
Now, most of us aren't the boss. What if we're in that position? We are, let's say, in an office, and we feel like we have to devote ourselves to keeping up with the emails, the texts, the, I don't know, Slack, whatever other online communication we use. How can we start, at least for ourselves, to bring back that human touch?
You know, I think it comes to two things. One, healthy boundaries. So, you know, people need to actually take vacation and, like, actually take vacation. Not having your phone is the new vacation, right? If you lose cell phone service, it can be healthy for your relationships. That's the world we live in now. So if you're on vacation, no, don't use email, don't text, and your boss has to be okay with that. And that's what's good. You know, I mean, Daimler in Germany, they have mail on holiday. If you email an employee when they're on vacation, your email's automatically deleted, which creates good behavior. So I think that's a huge thing, is creating boundaries. And then what we found in the research is it's about social events, team building activities, workation. Basically what it means is take your employees outside of the typical office environment and they'll open up.
Now, one thing that might be difficult, you really like face-to-face communication when that's possible in the workplace. And I'm right there with you. I'd rather walk over to somebody's office if I can than send them an email. But you're also, you favor phone conversations over the text or email when possible. And it seems like there's this culture change where we're really reluctant to pick up a phone and call each other.
Yeah, that's why it stands out more than ever before. And what I would say, too, is I think video conferencing is even better and more important, especially with remote workers. A third of workers globally work remote. 2/3 of them are disengaged. I think, you know, having video conferencing is important because at least you get to see someone. And, you know, most communication is nonverbal. And so to see how people are expressing themselves, and you get a better sense of who they are and what they're trying to communicate. So it can make things more clear than even a phone call. But if we're just defaulting to texting, you know, we tap our devices over 2,600 times a day. We look at our phones every 12 minutes. If we're constantly doing that, and that's, you know, if you get into an argument with your coworker, a text is going to make it worse. An email is going to make it worse, right? But if you're trying to remind someone to do something, a text and an email makes a lot more sense. If you want to do a team update on a Monday and send a debrief without action items, just an update, I think that's perfectly fine to send an email. But if you feel like, oh, my God, this is my 10th email and this person doesn't understand me, they probably don't. And that's a signal and feedback to you that you should pick up the phone.
How do you how does an organization establish a hierarchy of communication? Say, hey, in these instances, let's have that face-to-face. In these instances, set up the video conference. Here's what we as an organization use email for, and so on, to make sure that we're just skipping over a lot of those pratfalls that you just mentioned.
Yeah, I think it's having open discussions with people, figuring out what tools they want to use, how they best communicate, setting things that are consistent, right? So every Monday we do a video conference call and allow our remote workers to lead some of the meetings. You know, it's really setting the tone as a leader and making things that are consistent in terms of check-ins, because really what it comes down to is touch points. Every time you recognize an employee, every time you share something, every time you have a video conference meeting, all of this adds up to creating a more socialized, engaged workforce. And when you do that, people are more productive, the company grows, and you have better, less turnover. And you can't grow if you're constantly trying to replace employees that have weak connections within the company.
Now, a lot of what you talk about in the book is about communication, but at a more fundamental level, you're looking at happiness and fulfillment for workers. And you start with a couple ways we can measure ourselves or our employees. Can you talk about some of the questions we should be asking ourselves to figure out whether we're happy in our work?
Yeah, and focus on your own fulfillment before you try and help others. You need to be a role model for them, figure yourself out so that you are empowered, you bring positivity, and can really encourage them. And in terms of questions, it's about, like, you know, what are you good at? What have you been passionate about in the past? You know, what are your values? It's really about figuring yourself out. And a lot of people won't take the time, because of technology, we're always on, right, to actually sit down and think of, okay, who am I? What are my values? What's my vision? What's my leadership style? You know, what type of people should I surround myself with, in a sense, in the workplace setting? Who should I recruit? And that should be part of your recruiting criteria. So if you don't know yourself, you know, and you try and help other people, in the back of your head, when you're helping them, you're still thinking about yourself. And so you need a clear vision so you can bring other people along that journey with you.
And you've talked to CEOs of some pretty big companies and smaller ones along the way to writing this book. Are they buying what you're selling?
I think one of the most interesting, it's still early, you know, the book came out just a few weeks ago, but one of the things that's been confirmed is the biggest finding in the book, which was, it was pretty bold. It's like, if you work remote, you're much less likely to want a long-term career at your company. And it's very remote work, and having flexibility is very personal to people, right? And so when that stat came out, I was a little nervous because it's profound. It's something new. It's the dark side of remote work. Everyone talks about the freedom and flexibility to work when, where, and how you want, not the dark side. And more people in various audiences and CEOs say, yes, that is the dark side. We don't talk about it, but it's a conversation that we need to have.
We'll leave it there for now. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Dan Chabal is an author and the research director at Future Workplace. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Back to Human: How Great Leaders Create Connection in the Age of Isolation.